I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're bringing you some listener mail. Actually, Carney's bringing some listener mail. And I've been wondering if Carney's got something weird going on. I think he might have become conscious recently. And I'm not quite sure how to tell, but I'm getting some vibes.
Well, it makes sense because he does read all of the listener mail. And a lot of the listener mail that's come in has revolved around our episode on the idea of machine consciousness.
Right.
P-zombies and whatnot.
We will definitely explore some of that today. But of course, we've got to also get to some farts, some migraines, some Cambodian stegosaurus, and lots of other fun stuff.
Yeah, we've really dished out a variety of topics in the last month or two here.
Is there any way we couldn't start with the Fartonomicon? I think that's where we must begin. In fact, Carney himself is insisting.
Well, yes. It is the topic that we know everyone can relate to. You might not be that interested in AI topics. You might not be that interested in dinosaurs. But you cannot help but have some level of investment in the topic of flatulence. All right, Carney's bringing one over here right now. This one is from Marco. He writes, "Dear guys, the part of the fart episode where you calculated the amount of gas we expel each day reminded me of this, the greatest paragraph in 20th century literature from Samuel Beckett's 1955 novel, Malloy." I'm not familiar with this novel.
No, I haven't read it.
But here's the quote. "And in winter, under my great coat, I wrapped myself in swaths of newspaper and did not shed them until the earth awoke for good in April. The Times literary supplement was admirably adapted to this purpose of a never-failing toughness and impermeability. Even farts made no impression on it. I can't help it. Gas escapes from my fundament on the least pretext. It's hard not to mention it now and then, however great my distaste. One day I counted them. 315 farts in 19 hours, or an average of over 16 farts an hour. After all, it's not excessive. 4 farts every 15 minutes. It's nothing. Not even 1 fart every 4 minutes. It's unbelievable. Damn it, I hardly fart at all. I should never have mentioned it." The words of Samuel Beckett.
dignity echoing through my brain.
You know, this reminds me, too, that I believe we heard from another listener who pointed out some tidbits about Andre the Giant's farts that are apparently mentioned in the recent HBO documentary about Andre.
Oh, yeah?
And there is a tie-in to Samuel Beckett there as well, because there are these stories about how Beckett used to drive Andre to school.
So I assume that the story is they're thunderous. Are they thunderous?
That, yes. If there's a story about Andre, you know it's about him doing something to gigantic proportions.
You know, I've always had a kind of weird fascination with this kind of mentality, the character that's being described in the novel here, the kind of unstoppable quantitative curiosity about the machinations of your own physical body. It makes me think of Santorio Santorio, right? The guy who weighed everything that he ate and then everything that came out of him for, I can't remember, it was like a year or something, a long period of time.
Yeah. Make every aspect of your life a science experiment. Another interesting aspect about all this that comes to mind is the fact that, of course, most of us do not sit around counting and numbering our farts.
But you're saying we should.
Well, it makes me think about the future of biotechnology, you know, used to keep a real-time tabs on our health. It makes sense that there will be a fart counter at some point.
And it's going to have like a share to Facebook button. Like, I farted 42 times today. Yeah. Tell your friends.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, you'll probably have the two categories, right? The people who share out an exceedingly low number and those who share out an exceedingly high number. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see how that works, because it does seem like the basic kind of biometric that will be recorded by these devices. And It'll for some of us, it'll be like hitting that screen on a video game where it tells you how many hours you devoted to playing it. You're going to be a little astounded at how many farts passed you by.
That is a profound insight. It really could. It could get you that way. I can also see it leading to health trends. You know, once you have it quantified in front of you, people are going to start thinking about it, which will make them like create theories about it. Mm-hmm. You know, even if those theories aren't very scientifically informed, there's going to be like the equivalent of fad diets, but for how much you should fart. It's going to be the oil pulling of your butt.
Ooh, and then what if our biometric devices have some at least limited form of artificial intelligence, and then they communicate with us and they say things like, "Dave, you haven't farted enough today, Dave. Quit holding it in, Dave. It's not healthy.
Dave, you have bread farts." All right, here's our next response to the Fartonomicon episode. This is from Keith. Keith writes, "Robert and Joe, I've wondered for a while what the political implications of farting might be. Like, for instance, say there's a meeting between diplomats or leaders, and one of them is particularly gassy. Did you come across any examples of how something like this could make negotiations go awry because the other party is disgusted, whether consciously or not? Are there national security protocols surrounding flatulence? I know you touched upon farting in front of royalty in medieval times, but I'm wondering if there are more contemporary examples. Do you think U.S. presidents wear those activated charcoal linings when they meet foreign leaders? For some reason, when I picture a recent meeting between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping, I just imagine them both letting off some serious steam. Thanks for reading. Love the show."
Well, I have a few thoughts on that before we get into any historical examples. First of all, I feel like any world leader, of course, is going to have a security detail. Mm-hmm. The president of the United States is going to have Secret Service agents present. And I feel like I don't have any hard data on this, but I suspect that they are there not only to take a bullet for the president, but also to claim any disruptive episodes of flatulence as well.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
They take the reputational bullet.
Yeah. They say, "Oops, I'm sorry, Mr. President. That was me again."
So normally you'd blame it on the dog, but now you can blame it on agent so-and-so.
Right. But then the dog is a good point too. There's always a presidential dog, right? And maybe that is ultimately the presidential dog's purpose, is to diffuse any awkwardness in meetings with other high-ranking world leaders.
I'd never thought about it that way, but it makes sense. You've got me on the hook.
But I believe you have some actual data, some actual historical details regarding the disruptive nature of flatulence.
Well, I don't have anything good political from recent times. I've got some older stuff. And I found one example of a maybe not politically, but at least legally important fart. So in 2008, a man in West Virginia was pulled over for driving without headlights. I read about this in NBC News. He's pulled over for driving without headlights, given field sobriety tests, fails the sobriety tests, and he's being arrested by police. Sometime during his arrest and interaction with the police, he allegedly farted and wafted it toward one of the officers, and then he was charged with battery.
Ah.
The complaint said, quote, "The gas was very odorous and created contact of an insulting or provoking nature," which is – that's just cop language to the core.
Yeah. Well, I was it stick?
No, the charges were dropped. Okay. I think they realized they couldn't make that stick.
Yeah. Well, that it would be a rough precedent to establish, right?
Yeah.
That flatulence is battery.
I mean, when you're talking to the police, you're probably nervous, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff that's going to come out. So I imagine they should be used to it, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, I also found a great kind of breezy, fun article in the Daily Beast by the English historian and theologian Candida Moss, which mentions some of the most politically consequential farts in history. just a few examples she drew my attention to. One of them is that in the ancient Persian religion of Manichaeism, we talked about some other religious implications of farts, but not in Manichaeism. In this religion, farts were holy, apparently, because they literally believed in what Moss describes as the idea of an act of freeing divine light from the body.
Huh.
That's what a fart constituted.
Wow, that does remind me of some messaging that I've heard in yoga classes before. In two ways, I had a yoga teacher once who had everybody get into a happy baby pose. This mm-hmm. is where you're on your back and you're. Your legs are kind of akimbo, and you're holding your feet, mm-hmm. and everyone was instructed to let your anus like shine like a flashlight. but then it's also one of the realities of going to a yoga class is occasionally there are toots. I mean, everybody's, especially if it's like first thing in the morning, like people are showing up, you're twisting your body into new positions, mm-hmm. and sounds are going to erupt. And everyone has to kind of handle it with a certain amount of decorum. Mm-hmm. Sometimes a yoga teacher will, they don't call anybody out, or at least I've never been to a yoga class like that. That would be terrifying. But occasionally they will provide some messaging on toots and will even encourage it and say that like if you toot during yoga class, like that is a good thing. That means that your body is activated by what you are doing. And I tend to like it when there's at least some level of messaging like that in the class.
So it's not – what I imagine when you first said they talk about it is they'd be like, Robert, stop it.
Well, here's the other great thing about yoga classes. As long as there are more than two people, as long as it's not just you and the teacher, you almost always have plausible deniability. so it's the one-on-one classes you need to be worried about.
That sounds scary.
Or not worried about, depending, again, on just how clearly it's established that a few toots are okay.
Now, speaking of the master-student relationship here, we could also go to the cult of Pythagoras, the ancient Greek philosopher and arguably cult leader. Pythagoras, apparently, according to some beliefs, he taught that people should not eat beans. There's a great medieval engraving I've got of him. Not engraving. It looks like an illustration of Pythagoras standing across from some fava beans and just holding up his hands like, get out of here with those. Do not eat beans.
Well, what was his reasoning? He just did not like them, or was it the toots?
Well, a possible reason for this is that Pythagoras apparently believed that it was possible to fart out your soul. And this makes more sense if you know a little bit about the words in the Greek language for soul. So in the Greek language of the time, the words for the spirit or the soul, that word was pneuma, P-N-E-U-M-A, like from the same source that we get the word pneumatic.
Mm-hmm.
And in Greek, this was literally the word for breath. But for example, in several books in the New Testament, God or the Holy Spirit is called pneuma, meaning that it's an immaterial spirit or soul. But literally the word being used in the text there is the word for breath. So God is breath.
Huh.
Souls are breath. And of course, to the ancient Greeks, one type of breath was, as Moss points out, a fart.
Huh.
So the idea of farting out one's soul is not necessarily as weird as it first sounds. That seems like something kind of linguistically plausible.
Oh man, but also again, it just seems like you're working yourself into a corner with this kind of thinking because the farts are going to come, And if you're tying that and tethering it to some idea that you're losing some portion of your soul each time, that's just a losing proposition.
Yeah, I don't know how that worked out. I mean, it seems like a bad early example of religious body shaming.
Yeah. I mean, not that different really from some of the accounts we saw where it was connected to the idea that there was some sort of an evil spirit in you producing this gas.
We're really no better than the Pythagoreans now, are
yeah.
we?
But to demonize beans, that actually surprised me, because I just kind of assumed that beans were going to be okay with any religion or weird sect or cult, that there's always going to be a place for beans, no matter what other, you know, meats or dairy products that you exclude from your table.
Well, yeah. I mean, you got to think, how can you do geometric proofs in the sand if you're not eating beans? especially since I think it's also believed to some extent that Pythagoras advocated vegetarianism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, what are you left with?
Just leafy greens, I guess.
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting. All right, but how about some higher stakes examples here?
Okay, one more example that Candida Moss mentions. She draws my attention to this story in Herodotus.
Huh.
And I looked this up. So Herodotus is chronicling a case where a fart supposedly didn't necessarily cause but intensified an ongoing revolt against an Egyptian pharaoh. So you've got a 6th century BCE Egyptian pharaoh named Apres, who found out that his general Amasis had become part of a plot to rebel against the pharaoh and crown himself the general king. And so the pharaoh is sending a servant of his named Patarbemis to talk the general down and sort of bring him back into the fold. And here's where I read the quote from Herodotus, quote, "On intelligence of this event, the king sent Patarbemis, one of the most faithful of those who yet adhered to him, with directions to bring Amasis alive to his presence. Arriving where he was, he called to Amasis. Amasis was on horseback, and lifting up his leg, he broke wind and bade him carry that to his master." Pharaoh didn't take this well. When the message arrived, he was really upset, and he was so angry he actually cut off the nose and ears of the servant who delivered it. And this supposedly was so cruel that it actually encouraged more people to turn against the pharaoh Apres and join in Amasis's rebellion, which successfully deposed the fart-offended king.
There's a lesson here in being too uptight about fart humor, I think. You know,
yeah.
If he just played it a little cooler, maybe he wouldn't have come off like a tyrant and lost some crucial support here.
I think that's a deeply astute observation. You gotta keep your cool around farts; they can be your undoing.
You know, to return to the question of modern politics and farts, and there may be some excellent examples out there, we do have to remember that we have some fairly awkward and even embarrassing meetups between world leaders that happen with a fair amount of frequency,
yeah.
But people have been vomited upon.
Yeah, I'm thinking about who was it? George H.W. Bush who
yes.
vomited at a Japanese state dinner?
Yeah, it was a Japanese state dinner, if I recall correctly. And you know that did not harm relations between the two
sick,
countries.
You know?
People know that barfing happens. You know, and likewise, there are always awkward handshakes. It seems in the news and. People work through that. So I can't imagine a fart would be too disastrous these days, unless, again, tensions were already so high that you were just one fart away from war.
Here's an interesting question. I wonder if world leaders have code signals worked out. So imagine they're in a tense negotiation and they need to fart. Do they work it out with their aides that there's something they can do where an aide will come to them and say, We need you. We need you to come outside for a second for a secure message or something so you can go out in the hall and fart and then go back in and resume having, you know, without quite so much stress in your life.
Huh. You know, and another way of looking at it, though, is that perhaps it is advantageous for a world leader to have like one fart ready.
Mm-hmm.
To actually, disarm the tension in the room.
Because
if things get too tense, a fart could be a lifesaver because it's ultimately this humanizing comedic moment, assuming that the individual who emitted it is willing to own that moment and appreciate the humor of it.
You've got to know your enemy, who's across the table from you. Know, will they take a fart as offense or will it break the ice?
Yeah.
quick poll question for all the listeners out there. What percentage of people have at some point in their life pretended to take a phone call so they could go outside of the room and fart?
I look forward to the results on that question. All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will jump back in to our listener mail. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
All right, we're back.
Okay, this next one comes to us from our listener, Anna. It's on the Vault episode we recently aired about bird intelligence. Anna writes,
Hi, Robert and Joe. I enjoy listening to your podcast. I liked listening to your Vault episode about bird intelligence. One of my favorite examples of bird intelligence is the use of fire. In the northern parts of Australia, birds of prey, kites and falcons, have been seen picking up smoldering sticks, carrying them, and dropping them further away. This ignites the bushland and causes insects and rodents to flee.
Huh.
This bird then eats the fleeing rodents and insects along with its bird friends. These birds have been collectively called fire hawks by local Aboriginal peoples. They have legends about fire and birds in their culture. Anyway, love your work. Keep it up.
Oh, wow. That is impressive. That's some straight up Jungle Book stuff right there.
That's amazing. I looked that up. I was like, not that I didn't believe you, but I kind of had to see it for myself. So I haven't been able to find like pictures of this happening because apparently this is something that's been known about by many, especially of the northern Aboriginal peoples of Australia for a long time. But there's only recently been an effort to scientifically document the phenomenon. And the big question is, are the birds doing it on purpose, right? Mm-hmm. So we believe we hear all these anecdotes that people have witnessed this, but are they picking up smoldering sticks by accident and maybe they think they're prey or something and then dropping them? Or are they actually intentionally starting fires?
Interesting. It'll be interesting to see how that shakes out.
I mean, I wonder in a lot of different ways how fire can be encoded into our instincts and into our brains in a kind of deep genetic level. I think we talked about this in a couple of episodes we did about fire a long time ago, but there's always the question of like, how do you become a primate that starts to master fire? So if you're previously a primate who, you know, for all kinds of good reasons would want to run away from fire, mm-hmm. fire is dangerous. You don't want to like sleep next to a big forest fire.
Right.
But at the same time, fire can give you great benefits if you know how to predict its movements, if you know how to even capture it and use it. So what types of phenomena biologically in terms of behavior and instinct and natural appetites and stuff like that will actually lead you to become the kind of creature that can tolerate fire, can understand fire, can master fire?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question because we don't always realize it, but fire is part of our natural environment,
mm-hmm.
and it has been throughout the history of certainly of surface life on the planet.
Yeah,
so it makes sense that other animals would develop strategies for fire as well, even though the most predominant strategy is going to be, of course, flee from it. Or find safety from it. It does make sense that other creatures might pick up on at least minor ways to benefit from it or manipulate it.
In our City Evolution episodes, we talked about the idea of neophilia, right? Mm-hmm. The idea of animals having certain traits for being drawn towards strange, unusual, unfamiliar objects. And a lot of times in nature, that's not a good idea, right? Those objects mm-hmm. can be dangerous, but one can think of fire as a kind of archetype of that sort of object that accompanies both the risks and rewards. Fire can kill you if you don't treat it right, but it can also drive prey your way. Or if you are some kind of early hominid, you could maybe even use it to start more fires and keep a campfire.
I just can't help but now imagine a raccoon with a Zippo lighter
mm-hmm.
and all the horrible things that could transpire because of it.
It's funny, but you know, I wonder. Mm-hmm. So give raccoons thousands more years in human cities where people keep discarding cigarette lighters on the sidewalk.
What makes me thankful for the child light? We have our various charcoal grill lighters, mm-hmm. the sort of long-necked lighters. Generally, you have that two-button combination,
right?
And a human child is often incapable of activating it.
But crafty raccoons,
maybe. but if we did not have that child lock already in place, if it wasn't already childproof, mm-hmm. it would just be ready for the raccoons to run wild with.
We've got to stop thinking about this. Yeah. We're going to a scary place.
All right. Speaking of a scary place, we have a bit of listener mail here from James on machine consciousness. James writes, towards the end of Machine Consciousness and Pea Zombies, you made a comment to the effect that the advance of artificial intelligence is inevitable, and the best we can do is guide it in the right direction. I would argue that the development of the atomic bomb was also inevitable, given the state of scientific research at the time and the overwhelming need to win the Second World War. AI and atomic weapons are both fruits of human scientific research. Both have the potential to wipe out the human race. Is it really inevitable that the human race will always pursue scientific research even faced with the risk of self-annihilation? This sounds insane to me, and also true.
Yeah, James, I think that's right. I mean, one of the things that's kind of scary about atomic weapons is that in a sense, you could almost say that they're not invented so much as discovered. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're there. They're there in the laws of physics. They're there in the fissile materials that you find naturally in Earth's crust. I mean, the potential is there, and it's just a thing waiting to be discovered by someone who puts a few things together about their observations and realizes, like, oh, wow, this is what we could do.
Well, it's one of the reasons that self-annihilation factors into our contemplations of extraterrestrial life, because things like this are there to be discovered. And it makes sense that other potentially intelligent life forms would make the same discoveries and risk self-annihilation as well.
Yeah, and it's even scarier when you apply that back to us. I mean, mm-hmm. It makes you realize we can't ban it, right? You know, we can't just say like, oh, we will never allow anybody to create nuclear weapons anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a way, that would be a good thing. I would like a world without nuclear weapons, but it's always going to be out there for people to rediscover and do again with materials available on Earth.
Yeah, and I think this is largely the story of technology. AI is probably one of the most interesting, contemporary and near future examples. The atomic bomb is, of course, the most horrifying example of our time. But if you look at the 19th and 20th century advancements in chemistry, you see a number of other potent examples, mm-hmm. Producing both the chemistry of life and the chemistry of death. For instance, German biochemist Richard Kuhn discovered the deadly formula for the chemical weapon Sommer in 1944, and that was a mere 6 years after winning the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his work on life-enhancing carotenoids and vitamins. Sarin gas emerged in 1938 as a German pesticide. And the U.S. military chemical weapon BZ started out as a rejected gastrointestinal medication. And this is because during the Cold War, U.S. Army researchers at Edgewood Arsenal would sort through roughly 400 rejected medications a month to find potential weapons.
Wow.
So in this attempt to discover all these wonderful medications that would enhance our lives, we were, of course, finding things that didn't quite work or outright didn't work because of their side effects. And then who was coming along behind them but these researchers looking for the ones with the side effects that could be weaponized. And then one of the biggest examples, too, is German chemist Fritz Haber won a Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1918 for the Haber-Bosch process. This is the main industrial process for the production of ammonia, and it's essential to the fertilizer industry. But in doing that, he also contributed greatly to the chemistry of death. He's considered by many to be the father of modern chemical warfare.
I think you're exactly right about all this, but we've just been talking about weapons so far, and this mm-hmm. goes far beyond weapons. I mean, all kinds of technologies that are not even conceived of as weapons are potentially self-destructive or self-annihilating for us. Think about how much good has been done for the world by fossil fuels.
Yeah.
I mean, they've brought tremendous productivity, allowed people to create technologies that save lives, that move people around, get them where they need to be, that increase agricultural yields, allow us to feed more people, that give us all kinds of technologies that we're totally dependent on. But now we're seeing like, oops, this comes with a side effect too, just like the risks posed by chemical weapons that come out of all the advances of the chemical industry. We've now got climate change looming on us because of all this great stuff we got out of fossil fuels. Stuff like this tends to pop up almost in every arena of technology you start to imagine. The more powerful it becomes, the more good stuff it can do for us, the more dangerous it is.
Yeah, and we see that today as well in our information technologies and in the potential rise of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, in a much more mundane sense, in a way that's not life-threatening in the way that ultimately climate change or, you know, everyday nuclear weapons are. You might sort of notice that the ways in which social media has become very useful and integrated into our lives tracks pretty closely with the degree to which social media has become a really negative force in people's lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, here's another one about machine consciousness. This comes from our listener, PJ. PJ says, "Hi, Robert and Joe, longtime listener, first-time responder. I'd like to offer some commentary on your recent discussion of machine consciousness. It's easy to see how we may already be on the slippery slope toward giving computer programs the same rights as people, even without answering the question of machine consciousness. Today, we already have virtual worlds where millions of people interact with each other using avatars. Some popular computer games may spring to mind, but even something as ubiquitous as Facebook will work for this hypothesis. These virtual worlds are co-opting an ever-increasing portion of our time, money, and identity. We invest more and more of ourselves into them and spend increasingly more time interacting with others through our avatar than we do in face-to-face encounters. In fact, our digital personas are already measured by how many interactions we have in this virtual world. Metrics such as friends, followers, likes, and page views are already being used to weigh our relative worth on these platforms. We as physical entities are limited in the amount of time we can spend directly improving these metrics. At the very least, we need sleep, and most of us still have important offline responsibilities. But our avatars remain in that world 24/7. Currently, they are mostly inert and passive, but it's not hard to see an advantage in giving our avatar some limited ability to act for us in the virtual realm to represent our interests during our absence. We already have auto-response options that can deliver predetermined messages to those trying to reach us, auto-triggered in response to selected variables. As this trend toward automated avatars continues, our digital selves will begin to take on more of the decision-making load for us, at first in a programmatic way, but perhaps later on in a way that more closely resembles artificial intelligence. After all, we are rewarded for improving our metrics as much as possible, so who wouldn't want time-saving measures that help us do that? Now let's advance the thought experiment to the next level, to a point where the virtual world is on an equal footing with the real world, where the vast majority of all interactions between us are conducted via our automated avatars. Some tech-savvy youths may already be at that point. Again, this is not hard to imagine based on the technological trends we see today. At some point, it will be difficult, perhaps impossible, to tell whether you are interacting with a real person or an auto-responsive avatar. In fact, it may not even matter, as avatars become invested with more information and decision-making power that they may as well be considered an extension of that person's mind. When someone's avatar responds to you, it is no different than the person responding themselves. It just happens to be in a delayed or pre-programmed fashion while their physical body is asleep or away doing something else.
Huh.
Someday in the future, will we wake up, check our Facebook feed, and be given a summary of the various interactions our avatars have had online while we were sleeping? Get the gists of entire conversations held by our avatar with the avatars of others? See a readout of the many likes and comments given by other people's avatars to the funny memes that our avatar auto-generated on our behalf? View the results of the business meetings our avatar attended for us, double-check the tasks it volunteered us to do, and then click a button to have our avatar automatically perform those tasks. In such a world, when somebody's physical body dies but their avatar continues to represent them at 100% functionality, will we have the heart to pull the plug on that avatar? Do we even have the right? What if the real person left instructions for their avatar to remain behind to continue their interests after death? What if the avatar is the one who drafted these instructions entirely on its own, acting as it always has in the best interests of the real person? We're not that far from this situation becoming a reality, and as you can see, it will present some thorny problems even without the question of consciousness. Thanks for the great shows. Keep them coming, PJ.
Well, that was a great bit of listener mail.
Yeah,
some excellent points made there. It's interesting, the idea of your sort of virtual self that is kind of that acts on your behalf as a proxy and is kind of a representative while you're sleeping, et cetera. This actually comes up in Peter Watts' novel Starfish.
Yeah,
where you have there's one character who keeps trying to get in touch with this very powerful corporate individual, mm-hmm. and instead of getting an answering machine each time or an answering service, he keeps getting the virtual avatar of that person that
okay.
is interacting on their behalf, and he doesn't want that. He wants to interact with the actual person. But it was an interesting one of many examples in that book that touched on some very realistic possibilities for our future entanglement with our virtual technology.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you there. I mean, I can see this happening, and it doesn't. I mean, it's one of those things that appears very troubling from a distance, but as you approach it incrementally, you can imagine how what looks troubling now will kind of get slowly accustomed to step by step, so that when it's actually the case, you won't see it as all that weird.
Yeah, because the basic proposition is great, right? Like, are you tired of doing your social media interactions for work, Joe? Then why don't we just have Virtual Joe do it for you, and Virtual Joe will just send you a summary at the end of the day, you know? And he's not going to do anything that you wouldn't do. He's not going to do anything that you haven't checked off on.
Mm-hmm.
And he will take, some of the load off your plate here.
I think this is a great idea for creating plausible deniability when people create terrible social media faux pas.
Yeah.
So somebody tweets something very ill-advised that they shouldn't have said. They mm-hmm. can be like, no, that wasn't me. That was my avatar. That was automated. Some kind of artificial intelligence malfunction.
Yeah. Yeah. Clearly that's what happened. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that either. But instant plausible deniability on all the worst tweets. Yeah, and God, there's so much to talk about in this particular listener mail. I mean, certainly, I feel like a lot of us have been online long enough now to encounter time and time again the weirdness, the awkwardness, the sadness of encountering a social media profile for somebody who is no longer living.
Yeah,
and it doesn't stop feeling weird. It doesn't stop kind of haunting you a little bit.
Yeah.
Whether it's whether it's like a family member or just like a random social media friend whose profile never goes away and occasionally shows up as someone else who likes it or follows a particular account. So I could see them having, if not legally protected status, then certainly culturally protected status, just the idea that of course you wouldn't delete that. Why would you delete this? This is essentially their tombstone. On the other hand, I would say never discount humanity's capacity to limit the rights of their fellow humans or take their rights away if
yeah.
there's something to gain from it.
Well, I mean, that was one of the most horrifying scenarios I think we explored in the original episode, is like you can even imagine cases where you have the rights of real actual people in competition with the rights of supposedly conscious virtual entities, and these supposedly conscious virtual entities end up trumping the rights of real people.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't even know for sure that these other entities are people. They might be, they might not be.
Well, it kind of comes down to the question of who's going to decide, right? Because I can think of – look at historic situations where one group of people is determined to be more human than the other,
yeah.
or to have more intrinsic rights than the other group. And just imagine those situations extrapolated into the virtual realm. You could very well imagine a situation where essentially it's like, oh, well, these are virtual bodies. Sure, but these are virtual bodies, some very important religious individuals, very important. They're members of very powerful families. Or
if they're AI, you could make the case that they get a lot done. These
yeah.
are job creators, right? These AI entities that they're very productive.
Yeah. So you can easily imagine them obtaining a privileged status over very real human beings. At the same time, it's kind of the whole build your shopping mall on a Native American graveyard situation. If there's some advantage to be taken in pushing virtual bodies aside, then I feel like there are going to be those who will do it. I just hope that they are then haunted, whatever they're – I'm not even sure exactly what the example would be. But I don't know, the server space that they end up taking away from these virtual bodies, I hope that the server space is then haunted by those deceased individuals.
Yeah, this area is just full of unresolved problems that I feel like we can't even really begin yet to understand how we should prepare for. And yet we've got to start preparing, right? I mean, it's no answer to just say like, we'll deal with it when it comes up, right? Mm-hmm.
All right. On that note, we're going to take one more break and then we will come back with more listener mail.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
Okay, we're going to try to get through a few more at a faster pace here. Now, this next one came into us from our listener, Teresa, also about the machine consciousness episode. Teresa says, hey, guys, when you were talking about the AI wanting to commit suicide as a reward at the end of its task, it sounded almost like the Meeseeks from Rick and Morty. To quote from them, existence is pain. Just a fun thought I had while listening. Keep up the great podcast, Teresa.
All right, so you have not seen these episodes of Rick and Morty yet.
No, people keep telling me that it's full of great scientific concepts that come up on the show all the time, and I would like it, but I still haven't watched it.
Okay, well, this is a great episode because I can't believe I didn't think of it when I was kind of spitballing about annihilation seeking AIs. The Meeseeks are these little blue sort of creatures, technological creatures that pop up kind of like genies, and they help you with a problem. But they want to help you with the problem as quickly as possible because they want to then vanish out of existence at the end of the problem. So they are kind of the perfect manifestation of what I was talking about.
Now, even though I don't watch the show, I can imagine that if this kind of technology is established, it surely must go very wrong, right?
Well, it goes wrong when they are asked to help solve a situation that does not have a fast and easy solution, because then they are at pains to just labor over it for days or weeks or months or however long to see it accomplished. But you don't have to worry about them rising to power. Afterwards, and abusing their power because all they want is annihilation.
Well, wait. This goes back to the first problem we talked about. Then, you know, we've been talking about the idea of AI parasites, but it's also a problem if there is actually conscious AI and we're abusing them.
Yeah, in this case, like you've created something with the Meeseeks that have a desire that is that runs counter to living organisms that want to reproduce. They don't want to continue their story and their existence or their genetic information. They want annihilation. And if we're denying them annihilation, then we're the monsters.
Right. That's just recapitulating the cruelty of existence all over again.
Yeah. All right. This one comes to us from Julian. This is about our Cambodian Stegosaurus episode.
Apparently, we did some literary injustice.
Dear Robert and Joe, I enjoyed your podcast on the underappreciated Stegosaurus. It was always my favorite, one of my favorite dinosaurs when I was a kid, and I remember walking on all fours with my butt in the air as the Stego seems to do.
Bravo.
I also happen to be a fan of Conan the Barbarian, the movie, and the Robert E. Howard, Robert Jordan, and various other authors who have brought Conan to life. So it was a particularly cool mashup for me. I definitely see the comparison, as the Stego and Conan both tend to bristle with spikes and plates. But I would caution against the comparison of Conan and the Stego in cunning and temperament.
Okay, then. Well, I get the feeling we're about to have a case made at us.
While I can't think of something less important or more pretentious than correcting someone on a dinosaur and fictional character comparison, I feel that Conan's honor must be defended, and by Crom, I will do it. While the Stego is postulated to be a gentle, dim-witted herbivore, Conan is described to be the antithesis of this. I am paraphrasing, but more or less, Conan in Howard's stories is the undiluted primal cunning of nature, poured into the mold of a human being. He has Wolverine-like senses and moves like a panther through the forests and plains undetected. He perceives animals and enemies that would be hidden to civilized men. Conan is also, ironically, far more civilized in things such as morality, honor, and chivalry than the various civilized cultures he encounters. He doesn't lie. He risks his life for his allies and the weak, and he never breaks his word, although he does these things while serving his own purposes. He's no goody two-shoes, but he often does the right thing and doesn't kill people indiscriminately. Conan is also fiercely cunning, often outsmarting his opponents when they outnumber or seek to ambush him. Conan manages to climb to the top of every, quote, pack of wolves that he runs with, although often such as in the story a witch shall be born. He joins such packs of bandits, outlaws, and brigands while crucified out in the desert and expected to die, let alone lead. Conan is also a poet and composes several poems that are sprinkled throughout Howard's stories, most prolifically in Day of the Dragon and the Scarlet Citadel. If you managed to read this far, I am sincerely thankful. Once again, I realize how inane the idea of writing this email is, and surprisingly, yes, I actually do have better things that I should be doing, but every once in a while, you get a spark of something you are passionate about, and you can't let it go, no matter how silly. What I hope to have impressed upon you is that despite the size, plates, and spike clubs in common, the lumbering Stego is vastly different from Conan, who was a pirate, a warlord, a thief, a ranger, a king, and has saved the world multiple times from evil wizards and demon gods. I thoroughly enjoy your podcast. Please keep up the good work. If this email was entertaining, let me know. Thanks a lot, guys.
Well, I can't pretend to be the expert on Conan that you are, Julian, but I do very much appreciate this email. I like a good pedantic correction on the virtues of a fictional character.
Yes, indeed.
One thing I think about a lot, which you mentioned, is that – so Conan, he, you know, he's violent. He can be a brute sometimes. He does a lot of bad stuff. But you mentioned he doesn't lie. I feel like that's key. That's key in a lot of characters, a lot of anti-heroes. For some reason, you can get a long way toward identifying with somebody if all you have to do is have them tell the truth.
Yeah, there's a brutal honesty to them.
Okay, this next email comes to us from our listener, Josephine, also about the Cambodian Stegosaurus episode, but branching off from that into a general suggestion. Now, in the Cambodian Stegosaurus episode, we talked about the outdated idea that the Stegosaurus might have had two brains. That's not true. That is not something that modern paleontologists think anymore, but it used to be argued. And so we contemplated what would it be like to have two brains, and here's where Josephine writes in. I've been listening to your podcast for a few months now, and I absolutely love the show. I love how you guys approach each of the topics and how open-minded you come across. I'm a first-year architecture grad student who has background in psychology, biology, art, and pre-med studies. I've been meaning to write to you guys for a while to say how much I enjoy listening to the podcast during late nights in the studio. Sometimes it's the only thing that keeps me awake during my way too frequent all-nighters. I'm currently listening to the most recent episode on stegosauruses and just had to pause to send this email. So you guys talked a little about the possibility of having two brains or consciousnesses inside one body, and it kind of reminded me of an article I read about the conjoined twins Christina and Tatiana Hogan, who supposedly share a mind, or craniopagus twins. There was another case where twins claimed being able to see out of each other's eyes to some degree. There have, of course, been various instances of conjoined twins, and I think it'd be a really interesting topic for you guys to explore. You guys do this well anyway, but subtopics like the history of incidences, types of conjoined twins, why or how it happens, separation, would all be neat to hear about. Maybe even talk about parasitic twins versus conjoined twins. Anyway, I hope this is at least some food for thought. Love the podcast. It's been my saving grace these past months slaving away in the studio. Well, you're far too kind, Josephine, but I think that's a really interesting idea. Now, Robert, I imagine you must have covered this a little bit on the show before, right?
You know, I'm sure it's come up, but I can't recall a specific conjoined twins episode. I do recall thinking about doing a conjoined twins episode. So maybe mm-hmm. It's one of those that just we've never gotten around to.
You know, it's something I would definitely want to handle right, because honestly, I can recall when I was younger watching like some TV documentaries about conjoined twins that I feel like were not very did not approach the subject with the right kind
right.
of tone. Obviously, this is a very interesting scientific topic, but also, you know, you want to remember people's humanity. And I remember watching some documentaries about this when I was younger that sort of treated it with a kind of freak show mm-hmm. mentality.
Yeah, there is a danger there. I mean, not so much for our coverage of it. I think we would handle it in a respectful manner. But even so, like, I think we both grew up surrounded by a lot of that, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, you look at like when I think of conjoined twins in media, I inevitably end up thinking of like a Tales from the Crypt episode where mm-hmm. the twist is that that one of the characters has a conjoined twin, that sort of thing. Or, you know, episode of The Simpsons where Bart is separated from his conjoined twin and the other twin lives in the attic, that sort mm-hmm. of thing. And so you have all those sort of freak show motifs competing for attention against the very real human stories involved.
And those stories have got to be truly fascinating, because this could be – I didn't even think about this option when we were talking about mm-hmm. it in the episode, the idea of having two brains in one body. I mean, in a way where you have two people who are essentially sharing a large part of their somatic infrastructure together but have two separate brains versus people who are actually sharing brain tissue to some extent. That's got to be one of the most interesting ways to explore the different ways that consciousness can manifest according to your anatomy.
Yeah. Now, one example, there's certainly no consciousness involved here, but in terms of just two brains and one organism, there is the example of the anglerfish, where the much smaller male anglerfish fuses with the larger female's body. And then all non-essential parts of the male essentially atrophy away.
That is a really fascinating example. But maybe you're too quick to dismiss the idea of anglerfish consciousness. Who knows? Who knows what the mind of the anglerfish holds?
Yeah. I imagine I tend to imagine it's rather simple in its wants and desires. And they mostly revolve around light and food. But who knows? Maybe I'm selling them short.
I mean, here's the way I'd put it. When an anglerfish comes at you out of the darkness, would you rather have overestimated it or underestimated it?
True. Yeah, true. Good point. They are rather frightening. All right. Here's one from Mike. Mike says, gentlemen, I've just recently finished listening to the episode on the I Ching and was left slightly disappointed that you didn't mention its place in pop culture as the tattoo shared by Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow in G.I. Joe. There were probably three other listeners who knew.
I have no idea what this is about.
But, well, I had to look it up. But and true enough, they do have emblems from the I Ching on their shoulders.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, he continues, but probably like me, they've had an interest in the I Ching thanks to the comics, and I really appreciated the episode because of it. Thanks for all the great podcasts, and keep it up. You make my commute in the morning much more tolerable. But yes, true enough, these two ninja characters from G.I. Joe do have I Ching hexagrams on their body. I'm not sure which specific hexagrams they have. I would hope that they are aligned with, productive or destructive movements according to their classification as either a G.I. Joe ninja or a Cobra ninja, but I'm not sure off the top of my head.
The wind turns. The experienced commander waits. Go, Joe.
Go, Joe. We also heard from a listener in India. Bhargav wrote in about our hyper-real religion episode, which we recently featured as a vault episode.
Mm-hmm.
They said, hello from India. I'm a software programmer living in Bangalore. I love listening to your shows, both Stuff You Should Know and Stuff to Blow Your Mind. I recently listened to one of your episodes about hyper-real religions. I like the way you discussed the stuff about the religion of FSM and Jedi. I thought I'd share one more local parody religion from my own country. It is called Dinkoism. Dinkoism is based on a comic character who is a superhero who lives in the forest. The character is from a comic that used to be published in a magazine called Bala Mangala. This kid's magazine used to be pretty famous in southern parts of India when I was a kid in the 90s. He is known as Dinkin in Malayalam and Dinga in Kannada. Thought it might be good to share this one. Keep up the great work. P.S. Attaching an image of our almighty Lord and Savior. Thanks in regard.
So this is a cartoon mouse that I get the feeling is basically along the same lines as the role played by the Flying Spaghetti Monster. It's
right.
It's mainly, from what I can tell just on reading a few things about it on the internet, mainly a parody religion created by skeptics to satirize religious invasions into politics and by mainstream religions.
Right. And if you look at the cartoon character, you definitely get a Mighty Mouse kind of vibe from him. It's a very, very, he mentioned it is a kid's character. This is not like a Superman or a Batman. This is more like a Mighty Mouse.
But he's got a great name. Like that sounds like a good name for a god. Dinkin.
Yeah. I like it. So thanks for sharing that with us.
Okay, this is going to be one last email, and this comes to us from our listener Maggie in reaction to, I think this is after the listener mail episode we did about responses to our face blindness episode, where we heard from lots of face blind listeners, and some mentioned that they got symptoms of face blindness related to migraine auras. Now, Maggie writes, hi, guys. I discovered your podcast a few months ago and have been binging ever since. Thanks for giving me something that feels like I'm enriching myself as I go about my relatively mindless, tedious job. A good episode really makes my day. I just finished listening to your episode on listener mail regarding prosopagnosia. Fascinating stuff. And the bit about migraine auras grabbed my attention. I've suffered from periodic migraine headaches since about 12. Anyway, I've got a less common type of aura for my migraines that I thought might interest you. I smell stuff that isn't there. It doesn't bother me except in that it indicates an impending episode. Actually, aside from the nasty migraine part, I kind of enjoy the weirdness of my auras. I can be whole states away from the ocean and suddenly smell salt marsh and burnt hamburgers.
Huh.
Or driving along and smell an overwhelming odor of dead rodent and daffodils. This one was in the dead of winter with no mice in my car. My passenger confirmed no such smell. It's almost always an intensely powerful smell that's a combination of pleasant and unpleasant. Bacon and skunk, rotting meat and lilacs. Usually the combination is so bizarre that I almost savor the experience rather than focusing on the unpleasant notes to the scent. It's just trippy to know your brain is lying to you, but to really feel like it's true. I can't describe how uncanny it is. There was only one time this weird symptom was entirely pleasant, when I was changing an adult man's heavily soiled Depends, and all I could smell was the intense aroma of very ripe bananas wafting up at me from the diaper.
Wow, that is quite an image.
She says, thank goodness for small blessings. It turned an otherwise unenjoyable chore into a moment of gratitude for my malfunctioning brain. When I have an aura, there is frequently a burning smell as one of the notes of the scent. A lot of the time, it's burned toast. Smelling burning is so common that when I do smell something burned, I usually ask anyone around whether they also smell it. If they do too, I know I'm going to be fine. My auras can hit anywhere from 10 minutes to a full day prior to a migraine, but they're usually around 1 to 2 hours ahead. Now, Maggie actually shares a lot of other really interesting details about her migraine symptoms that I think we might save. We've gotten multiple migraine emails that we might save for thinking about a full episode sometime in the future, investigating what migraines are and all these interesting neurological phenomena they create. But I wanted to just focus for a second on the idea of these phantom smells, and especially the idea of a burning smell. This is not just Maggie. I've read about this a lot. I mean, it's a very common thing you hear reported, so common that people almost make jokes about it, you know, not necessarily with migraine auras, but with any kind of neurological phenomena. Somebody makes a joke that you might be having a stroke. They say, do you smell burnt toast?
Mm-hmm.
Why is the burning smell so deeply associated with non-neurotypical phenomena? If you got some kind of neurological event going on in the brain, we've learned to associate it with not just phantom smells, but specifically burning smells. And I have read a little bit that this is actually something that's widely reported.
Huh. Well, it kind of takes us back to our discussion of birds and fire and in human history with fire, and
yeah,
makes me wonder about the survival advantage one would have in identifying either the smell of wildfires or maybe later on the smell of campfires maintained by some other group of humans.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, it just makes me wonder about like the ways in which the typical chemical signature of something burning might be hard-coded to some kind of neural pathways in the brain.
Yeah.
Why is that so commonly selected and identified as a type of phantom smell among the millions that you could be identifying?
And of course, the other cool thing about this is that we're getting into just the phantom nature of smell itself. There's so much going on. You can be walking down the street and catch a particular aroma, and it'll be like a thing that is not quite like codified in your head, you know, but it'll take you back to something from your childhood, something you haven't thought about in decades.
Yeah,
smell has this amazing power over us, and then when you have that crossed with migraine auras, it makes for a rather magical, in some respects, experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just reinforces so well the fact that the thing you think with is not a thing that you can understand. The brain is a black box. The brain is the thing you use to understand the world, but you can't really understand how it generates the thoughts that you have.
Do you think a migraine aura could also produce the scent of a really, you know, sulfurous fart? And therefore might tie into some of our examples that we discussed in our Fartonomicon episode of encounters, either fart-based encounters or fart-based deterrents to demonic entities.
I think you are going down a very fruitful path of inquiry there. I think we should pursue that more in the future.
But we have reached our limit for this episode, maybe even gone a little bit over, which is difficult to avoid when we have so much great listener mail. Again, yeah. we try and read everything. We don't have a chance to respond to everything, and we certainly don't have a chance to read it all on the podcast. But we do want you all to know that it is very much appreciated.
Yeah, we really do love all the wonderful listener mail we get. So please keep them coming.
That's right. And as always, I do ask everyone for a little R&R, a little rate and review. If you have the opportunity to do so, wherever you get this podcast, give us some stars. Leave us a nice review. It helps us out. In the meantime, check out all the podcast episodes at stufftoblowyourmind.com. If you heard us reference an episode in this listener mail that you haven't listened to and it perks your interest, then head on over to the mothership, to stufftoblowyourmind.com, and look it up. You'll also find links out to our various social media accounts that you can follow as well.
Thank you so much, as always, to our wonderful audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us to let us know what you thought about this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, just to say hi, or to maybe end up on a future listener mail episode yourself, you can always email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi. I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.